Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, December the 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Obama makes his final national security speech to American service members.
Today, by any measure, Core Al-Qaeda, the organization that hit us on 9/11, is a shadow of its former self.
The president-elect is making deals and tweeting his dislike for the cost of new presidential planes.
This is very unusual territory. Presidents don't usually pick fights with corporations.
Also ahead, the Grammy nominations are in. We'll talk to Entertainment Tonight. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, in his final major speech on national security, President Barack Obama visited MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, where he praised the work done by the U.S. Special Operations Command and U.S. Central Command. Those are the units in charge of special operations elements of the Army, Navy, and Air Force.
To say that we made progress is not to say that the job is done. We know that a deadly threat persists. We know that in some form, this violent extremism will be with us for years to come.
Well, when Obama took office in 2009, the United States had been at war for 8 years in Afghanistan and 6 in Iraq. Joining me now for more on President Obama's speech is VOA White House correspondent Cindy Sain. Cindy, tell us exactly what the president said.
The president took the opportunity to thank U.S. Special Operations Forces and other troops, saying that they had helped keep the country safe over the past 8 years, saying there had not been a successful terrorist attack executed on the homeland in those years. And he also said that when he took office, there were some 180,000 U.S. troops deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that number is now down to 15,000. And he said this was a big shift, and it marked a deliberate effort by him to reduce American casualties and also to reduce the cost for the United States.
And so, obviously, it sounds like he also did tout some of his, what he would consider successes of his presidency.
Yes, he did. And he also said that with regard to the so-called Islamic State terrorist group, that their caliphate, as they would call it, has shrunk down 50% in Iraq and also shrunk in Syria, saying that the bottom line is that the international coalition has broken the back of the Islamic State group. So he said there were great successes there as well.
Did he talk anything about torture?
Yes, he did. He used the speech, without ever mentioning President-elect Donald Trump by name, he used the speech as an opportunity to say that upholding U.S. core values, such as respecting civil liberties and human rights, was a strength. It was not a liability at all in countering terror around the world, but one of our biggest strengths. And he said that we should never make the war on terror a war against Islam, and that protecting liberties should go for all Americans. And many took this as an implicit rebuke to Trump for his calls during the campaign for a ban on Muslims.
Right. And then, of course, Donald Trump has also talked about using torture to capture terrorists or to get information from terrorists.
That's right. And the president said that he was proud that under his administration, torture, including waterboarding, had been prohibited, and that he had never had any intelligence official tell him that they had lost some kind of valuable information because of that. He said just to the contrary, that it had actually helped, and it also helped other countries to be more willing to cooperate with the United States. So that's another thing where he said that he hopes in the future that other administrations would also not use torture or waterboarding.
Is this sort of standard operating procedure for a president that's leaving office to go talk to the troops and thank them and talk about the highlights of what they've achieved, or is this something new?
I think that this is standard, that it had been planned in advance. It was a bit poignant for the president. He said when he heard the band play Hail to the Chief as he came in, it was the last time he would be hearing that on the road. Mm. So you notice that it was very emotional for him, meeting with the troops and saying that actually it was them that put their lives on the line, and it was them who had kept the country safe.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate it. VOA White House correspondent Cindy Sane. Well, turning now to what's been trending on social media today, we are joined by G. Abby Lee. Hey, G. So what are people talking about?
Hi, Lori. It's an interesting day to mull over America's ties with East Asia in terms of business relations. First, let's take a look at two tweets from President-elect Donald Trump. Masayoshi Son of Japan's SoftBank has agreed to invest $50 billion in the U.S. toward businesses and 50,000 new jobs. Son said he would have never done this had we, Trump, not won the election. Trump made a joint announcement with the Korean-Japanese CEO at the Trump Tower today, and to tell you a little bit about Son, he's the founder and CEO of the SoftBank Group and the chairman of American telecom provider Sprint. Not surprisingly, he's the second richest man in Japan.
Oh, looks like a pretty positive development at first glance, at least. What's the reaction like from internet users?
Naturally, Trump supporters are touting the possible job creation and investment on American soil, but financial reporters and writers had something a little different to tweet. Alec Ross, who is the author of New York Times bestseller, The Industries of the Future, sent out this tweet. Translation, under Donald Trump's FCC, which means Federal Communications Commission, Son will be able to merge Sprint with another wireless carrier. And it appears that carrier could be T-Mobile. The number of jobs Son pledges to create in the U.S. is 50,000, which is roughly the number of T-Mobile employees.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. So anything else trending?
Yep, another story that can impact the U.S.-East Asia relations in the mobile sector. In an unanimous decision, the American Supreme Court favored South Korean electronics giant Samsung in a patent suit with U.S. tech company Apple. That means the case will be resettled to the lower court, throwing out a $399 million judgment against Samsung for infringing on three of Apple's design patents for the iPhone. Twitter users are calling it a big win for Samsung. Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. His spokesman says Donald Trump sold stock and bond holdings in June. Iranian president threatens U.S. over sanctions extension. A Mexican mayor invites Trump to meet workers who won't get jobs. Children who lived through Pearl Harbor attack remember what happened. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, in contrast to the announcement about a Japanese company committing to investing billions in the U.S., as we heard from G, President-elect Donald Trump sent out a surprising tweet on Tuesday that could cost one of the leading U.S. companies billions. He tweeted that the U.S. should cancel an order for a new Air Force One, the plane that flies U.S. presidents around the world. The government has contracted with the Boeing company to construct at least two new planes, which would go into service in 2024. The planes initially cost about $3 billion, but the costs have reportedly been rising, prompting Trump to tweet, "The costs are out of control." Joining me now to discuss is Jeremy Mayer, associate professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thanks for being with us. So what is your take on this?
His tweeting often is in response to what he sees on TV. And it seems plausible to me that this is a response to what Boeing spokesperson said on TV.
My understanding was that there was an article in the Chicago Tribune, a column actually, quoting the CEO of Boeing that did offer some tepid criticism of Trump's aggressive trade rhetoric against China, and that this came within an hour of that.
That could be easily what caused this. The point is, we are about to have a president who launches attacks and thoughts right off the top of his head, straight to Twitter. And in the long history of this country, we've never had a president so directly linked to publicity.
From an economic perspective, it would seem that he's trying to save the U.S. money.
Oh, yes, there is a populist aspect to this. And I think a lot of his hardcore supporters are going to look at this and say, well, that's what I would do if I were president. It's the job of the president to fix things. And when he sees something wrong, to say it, to straight talk and say what everyone else is thinking. But the thing it actually reminds me of is the way Putin works in Russia, that Putin exists to get complaints from anyone in Russia and then fixes any problem that is brought to his attention in this very dramatic one-man-solves-everything way. And I think that's what Trump is doing.
You don't think he's actually concerned that this is an expensive endeavor?
Oh, I think that he could well be concerned. We would all be concerned about when we see the price tag of various government, particularly military weapons programs or plane programs. They all look very expensive. But a restrained, careful politician would examine why. Like if you read what the Boeing spokespeople are saying tonight, why are these planes so expensive? Why do they cost so much more than other 747s? Well, because the government has requested extraordinary security measures and communication measures.
Right. So it's not just a normal plane that the average person would be flying on. This didn't fare well, though, for Boeing stocks.
Right. So this is something that should concern people. I mean, the businesses that Trump favors, that make deals with Trump, that respond to his public harangues like Carrier did, are going to be looked on with favor. And the businesses that don't play nice with Trump may suffer at the stock market or in government contracting. And that's not the American norm. This is very unusual territory. Presidents don't usually pick fights with corporations. Name calling on corporations is unprecedented in my knowledge.
Historically, Republicans in particular have been very pro-business and pro-free trade, and some of these corporate chiefs are more accustomed to being treated gently.
No, the business of America is business is an old Republican approach to the economy. And I think that Trump is a different kind of Republican, and that has upsides and downsides for his presidency.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Jeremy Mayer, he is the associate professor at George Mason University. On Monday, while continuing to screen candidates for his cabinet, Donald Trump also met with former Democratic Vice President Al Gore, who said he had a lengthy and very productive meeting with the president-elect.
The bulk of the time was with President-elect Donald Trump. I found it an extremely interesting conversation. To be continued. And I'm just going to leave it at that. Thank you.
My friend, like, what, have you
Who asked for the meeting? Who asked for the meeting, Sarah?
Well, Gore is a leading advocate for tackling man-made climate change and stands in stark contrast to Trump, who's called it a hoax. But he said recently that he was open to continued U.S. compliance with the worldwide Paris Climate Pact that took effect months ago. Well, the meeting, of course, follows the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and Climate Change, a one-day summit hosted by the New York Academy of Sciences. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made the opening statement for the day. And joining me now to talk more about this summit, UN Special Advisor Dr. David Nabarro.
It's different from any other agreement that we've had in the UN, certainly in my experience, and I believe since we were founded just over 70 years ago, because it was agreed by all the world leaders, and it's a plan for the future of our world and its people. And we've never had a plan like this before. It links together all the different parts of life that are important to people everywhere. It links peace and security and development and human rights. But perhaps more importantly, it addresses what is the future for people, the future for the planet, the kinds of prosperity that we think are the right way to move forward, ways to avoid harm and violence in resolving conflict, and partnerships for making the future happen. And it applies to every country, to every community, to every organization. It's a universal plan, and it's not just an idealistic thing, because it was actually agreed by world leaders unanimously. And since it was agreed, more than 100 countries have started to put elements of this plan into their own political development strategies. And that's countries that range from Canada through to poor countries in Africa or Asia. And it's a kind of movement that will, we believe, lead to a world that's fit for future generations. Native American communities talk about 7 generations hence. And it's reasonable to perceive that the world could be viable in 7 generations' time if we follow what's in this agenda for sustainable development.
Can you give me a few examples of what some of those things are in that agenda?
It starts reducing poverty, and it also focuses on ending hunger and improving health. It's got an emphasis on education, as well as access to water and sanitation and clean energy. Right at the heart is a notion of gender equality, and then there's goals for climate, goals for the oceans, and goals for land.
So this isn't all about climate change. It's about everything that involves sustainability.
It is about everything. It's about the human, the environment, and it's about the way in which humans interact with their environment and produce wealth and share wealth and consume and produce and also maintain peace. It kind of covers every single aspect of human existence.
How difficult do you think it will be to actually implement all of these ideas?
It's a difficult challenge because it's the challenge that's needed for the future of our world. But we're finding that more and more political leaders everywhere see the importance of doing it and the need to get everybody on side behind it. And there's a recognition that if that it becomes something that everybody works on, we've got a chance of success. And the reason why it's so important, and people like myself spend all our waking hours on it, is that we know that if we don't do this, the consequences for future generations are just going to be awful.
How concerned are you and member countries following the U.S. presidential election and Donald Trump's threats to pull out of the Paris Agreement?
To get this kind of agreement taken forward, we really depend on political leaders staying true to their words and or the words of predecessors and holding the line with regard to things that affect the whole world. And during the 22nd Conference of Parties on Climate in Marrakesh that took place last month, the results of the US elections were very much hanging in the air. But what we found was that all the other countries present were extremely clear that they believe that the future of the world has to be one that's associated with reduced emissions of carbon. There's no turning back. And they also explained that moving to clean energy, moving to sustainable agriculture, doesn't mean having economic sacrifice. In fact, it creates jobs and it improves the economy. And so I think the view among other countries is that, yes, perhaps the U.S. president was making these points during his electioneering, but perhaps as he engages with leaders of countries that are at risk because they're climate vulnerable, or when he engages with U.S. scientists and business, and when he reflects on it, he will find that it isn't such a bad thing to stay in this climate agreement that has been so carefully worked on by countries. We've now got 112 countries that have ratified this agreement, which is an extraordinary number when the discussions only took place just over a year ago. And we actually think that there will be an alignment. We're not obviously in any way saying that people shouldn't say and do what they want to do, but just the number of American young people in particular who we know are concerned about climate change leads us to believe that there may in practice be a continued engagement by the United States. And the U.S. leadership up till now has been absolutely fabulous.
All right. Well, we certainly appreciate your time, sir. Thank you so much for being with us. That's UN Special Advisor Dr. David Nabarro. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Scientists have discovered a previously unknown stage of brain development in newborn babies. The research may help answer questions about the human thought process and lead to new insights about neurological diseases. VOA's Deborah Block reports.
Baby Grace is only about 2 weeks old. Scientists thought the circuitry of most babies' brains, like hers, develop before they are born. But new research indicates this circuitry is a work in progress that continues for months after birth. Scientists at the University of California in San Francisco discovered that tiny neurons believed to form deep in the brain migrate to the prefrontal cortex, a part of the brain that contributes to personality development. The findings may lead to new insights into how the brains of babies learn and change.
So it's just a fascinating phenomenon. What it happened in the embryo, now it happened in a much more complex brain that's bigger, more complex. The fact that these cells can make these long, long migrations, journeys from their site where they're probably born to their ultimate location where they're going to become integrated into circuits.
These circuits in the prefrontal cortex are thought to be linked to neurological disorders like autism and schizophrenia.
We have learned tremendously about brain development, but still it's a very, very small fraction of what we need to know to really understand how the brain functions and gets assembled. So it's fascinating that we're making progress so fast, but we have a long way to go.
So as baby Grace sleeps, her brain continues to shape the complexities of her reasoning, perception, and intuition. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the 59th annual Grammy Awards are just a few months away on February 12th at the Staples Center in Los Angeles and airing on CBS. It's music's biggest night to recognize outstanding achievement in the industry. And on Tuesday, this year's nominees were announced. Joining us now for details is Entertainment Tonight senior news editor Jennifer Perros. Hi, Jen. So tell us about the big contenders this year.
It's going to be the Adele versus Beyoncé Grammys. I mean, the two of them were both nominated for multiple awards. Beyoncé coming in on top at 9 nominations, and Adele with a total of 5. Some other front runners were Drake, Rihanna, and Kanye West, who are all nominated for 8 Grammys. And then Chance the Rapper, who is the new up-and-comer artist, he came in with 7 nominations. So Album of the Year, Record of the Year, of course, both have Adele and Beyonce. Song of the Year, of course, Formation by Beyonce, Hello by Adele. So it's definitely going to be the two of these ladies up against each other. And some surprises, Demi Lovato actually has her first Grammy nomination. A lot of people were surprised by that. Justin Bieber has been nominated for 3. He was nominated for Album of the Year. And of course, a lot of people were surprised by that. And a couple snubs. Sia, she is walking away with 3 nominations, but nothing in the Album of the Year, Record of the Year, Song of the Year, or Best New Artist. But, you know, we do think she will be taking some home as well. Best New Artist, we're seeing Kelsea Ballerini. She, of course, is America's new favorite country music artist. And, of course, the Chainsmokers, the 2 EDM duo from New York who have been around for years but have just made their name in mainstream music. You can't put the radio radio on nowadays without hearing one of their songs, and of course Chance the Rapper. So those three are definitely going to dominate the best new artist category, and it should be interesting to see who else takes more awards home that night.
We've got Beyonce and Adele really leading the pack here.
Yeah.
How did both of them do last year? Is this sort of a repeat of the favorites?
No, not at all. You know, of course, Adele won in 2008 for Best New Artist. I mean, she literally came out overnight, had her SNL performance, and then, you know, her hit song, and then won the Best New Artist, and her life really hasn't been the same. You know, she did take the last 3 years off to write her hit album, 25, and, of course, recover from throat surgery, and she had a baby. Mm-hmm. So we really haven't seen Adele in the past couple of years. It's also interesting to note, Beyonce, even though she does have 20 Grammy Awards already, she only has 10 on her own. The first 10 were with Destiny's Child, and this is the first time that she has been in one of the main four. She's only won one Grammy in the top four categories for all the single ladies for Best Song of the Year. So it should be interesting to see which one of the ladies will win that night.
All right, thanks so much. That was Jennifer Parros. She is the Entertainment Tonight Senior News Editor. We appreciate it. We've been listening to International Edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. That does it for today's show. Thanks so much for being with us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While military success against violent extremists is essential to security, it isn't enough to ensure that the terrorist threat will not just regroup, reconstitute, and resurface in the future. At the heart of countering violent extremism, said U.S. Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights Sarah Sewell, is the recognition that military defeat of today's terrorists is not sufficient to kill the ideology or address the broader factors needed to prevent new terrorists from emerging. In essence, CVE seeks to prevent the next generation of threats by helping the most vulnerable people and places resist terrorist recruitment and expansion. One aspect of this approach is to promote good governance and halt state policies that fan radicalization to violence. When governments fail to protect their citizens and respect human rights, they breed anger and resentments that violent extremists exploit. Examples abound. Boko Haram gained traction after Nigerian security forces suppressed peaceful protests and executed the group's founder, Mohamed Yusuf, without trial. Al-Shabaab exploits heavy-handed tactics by Kenyan security forces to win over new recruits. And in Afghanistan, the Taliban rails against government corruption to replenish fighters each year. How governments treat their citizens has a profound impact on the scope of terrorist threats. A second critical component of CVE is to build the resilience of vulnerable communities in which local leaders, parents, and peers know how to spot and address signs of terrorist radicalization, in which mentors or institutions can offer powerful counterarguments or provide alternative paths for those at risk. Where communities build such resilience, terrorist groups will struggle to find new followers and safe havens. The U.S. supports networks of women and girls around the world, including in South Asia, to act when they see signs of terrorist radicalization in their neighborhoods. The United States helped establish the Strong Cities Network to connect mayors and local leaders across the globe to exchange what works and what doesn't in stifling terrorist recruitment. Even as Daesh is losing ground and fighters on the battlefield, it is critical to remember that preventing the next generation of terrorists is every bit as important as defeating the current threat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is 4.